An economist from Scotland wanted to disrupt the economy of music. He boarded a train, landed up in London. Those were the days when music piracy was at its peak. And Will Page ended up working for Spotify as its chief economist. Rarely did we have any music industry company where they had a designation called as chief economist. So what did Will Page really do? Hello and welcome. I'm Pooja Sarkar and you're listening to the podcast From the Bookshelves of Forbes India. Will Page has written this book called as Stars in Economics, and the book has some very funny and interesting references and some very good case studies. What if I tell you that the boy band BTS, the sensation from Korea, there is a small town in Chile which streams most of their music all the time. The book isn't really about just music, while it does draw a lot of references from the industry. The book is an essential guide for any business on how to find gaps and tools and disrupt any industry. For more, let's say hello to the author. Thank you so much, Will, for coming to our show, and we hope you have a wonderful discussion today. Okay, thank you so much for actually doing this. When did you decide that you want to write about this book, and can you tell the listeners what this book is all about?
So my passion has always been teaching economics. Since the age of 11, my father taught me how to teach economics, actually before he actually taught me what economics was. And he always said, you need to focus on an audience who doesn't think they're going to understand economics, doesn't want to understand economics, but has to. So it's preaching to the unconverted. Economics books for economists is easy. Trying to explain economics to non-economists is not easy. And you know, that was my passion, is how do you get this subject, a scary subject to some extent, across to an audience that really doesn't want to know about it, but has to know about it. So that's been a driving force in me throughout my life. And I think with Spotify, after spending the best part of a decade there, seeing the company go public, there was an urgency to do the book, as it were. Spoke to Daniel, spoke to my parents, spoke to everyone around me, and everyone was like, this is what makes you happy, is teaching. Take time out from Spotify and take the path of the book. Now, the book had one big twist during it, which is obviously the pandemic. But essentially, if we think about the pandemic and we think about the book, what we're trying to say here is everybody is staring at disruption now. Everyone is staring at what I'm going to call their Napster moment. And the Napster moment was back in June 1999, the music industry globally woke up to illegal file sharing, the concept that you could go into the internet and find any song you wanted. The entire business was upended. Copyright stands for the right to control copying. It's in the word copyright. And we lost that right to control copying with file sharing. So the driving force of the book is that we've had a 20-year head start in music at dealing with this level of disruption. We were the first to suffer and the first to recover. And I'm sure that I can tease out some lessons, and in this case, eight lessons, eight principles that I've learned on that journey that everyone else can apply for. Their lives, their organizations, their political institutions, we're all staring at a Napster moment now, and this book is there to help those people navigate that level of disruption.
True. There's this one portion, there's this quote in the book which I really loved in the beginning. It says, there's somebody who told you that that's why we like to say a record collection defines who you are and a book collection defines who you really want to be. Who said it's that? Why did it stay with you?
So I've yet to ask for permission to name the publisher who gave me that quote. So he, Clue, will remain nameless for the time being. But that was actually, it was strange. That was in 2012, the year of the Summer Olympics in London. I went to this book publishing seminar, like New Technologies, and I overheard this remark because I was on stage and I said, Spotify works because you listen to the same song over and over again. So those little payments add up to a large amount of money. In books, it doesn't work because you only read the same book once. Rarely do you read a book a second time. This real veteran publisher at the back of the room, I actually got booed for saying that because everybody had believed that Spotify was a solution to the book industry. And this publisher at the back said, wise words, Mr. Page, wise words. You know, don't worry about people booing you. You're correct in your analysis. I was like, really? He said, yeah. He said, I run my business based on the fact that 80% of books sold are not consumed. I literally dropped my coffee. Like, what? He said, I've run my business for the past 30 years on the basis that 80% of consumption is not consumed by the consumer. They sit on a glass table, they sit on a dusty shelf, they're gifts. But the person who purchased that $14.99 hardback copy of a book didn't actually read it. I was like, that's a ton of breakage to have in a business model. That's a business built on thin air. How can that possibly be? And he said to me, that's why we like to say that a record collection defines who you are and a book collection defines who you really want to be. And I got home that night, looked at my record collection. I have over 3,000 vinyl records. I was like, I've listened to all of these. I own every John Coltrane album you can imagine, and I've listened to them all from start to finish. Then I looked at my book collections, like, I've read none of these. I've got Karl Popper there, but I've not actually read his work. I just want to be as brainy as my big brother. You know, it's comforting to know that his book's on my shelf, even though I haven't actually opened it. So it's wise words, and it makes you think about media. It really does. It makes you think about media and consumption.
True. But I'll come to the part, you know, when you talk about, can you tell our listeners, how did you join Spotify? And, you know, if you, there's some glimpses in the book, if you could tell listeners that you were in Scotland, you, what were you doing, and how did you come to, how did an economist come to join Spotify?
Well, I'll hop, skip, and jump to the very end of the book where I say, don't wait for your job description, create your job description. And for entrepreneurs listening in India, you know, that should be written on our foreheads, literally. How could you possibly assume that your employer knows what they're trying to hire, given this pace and scale of disruption we are all now witnessing? You know what you have to offer, so create your job description. Do not trust the one that's given to you. Supply creates demand, okay? And that's kind of how I started off in this career of becoming what I think is the first ever music industry economist, or a rockonomist, as I call it. Just briefly, you know, if you go back to March 2006, I'm in Edinburgh. I'm working for the Government Economic Service. I'm bored out of my brains, working on really sexy topics like local income tax. We could talk about that if you wanted. Not. And I'm on the bus going home, and there's a Financial Times on the bus. Now, I don't usually pick up newspapers on buses, but when it's a Financial Times, the benefits outweigh the costs. And I'm browsing through it on the way home. And just before I get off the bus, I stumble on this op-ed article, which had this title. Now listen to this title. The title says, Digital Ants Wreck the Music Industry's Picnic. Now, digital ants are wrecking everyone's picnic now, including newspapers, including the publication business. And I started reading the article. It's like, wow, this person really gets what I'm interested in, which is the economics of copyright, the economics of content, the economics of digital disruption. Back then, no one else was looking at this. Who was it? The chief executive of the Performing Rights Society. Now, my father didn't just teach me economics. He told me never to be shy approaching anyone. You know, the worst I can tell you to do is to back off. So I wrote this person a letter, actually corrected him on a few points in his essay in the Financial Times. Turned out he was very dyslexic, and he acknowledged my corrections with a lot of gratitude. And off the back of that letter, he brought me to London, interviewed me for an entire day, like a whole day of grilling on questions. How would you price a music catalog? Well, I don't know, but I would design an auction. Really? What auction would you design? And I would talk about how auctions can be used to reveal price. You can have ascending price auctions where you still bid up, descending price auctions where you start the clock at the top and you work down, first price yield bid, second price yield bid. There's all sorts of auction designs that you could apply here for pricing music. And I quickly realized nobody had thought about this stuff. And off the back of picking, it gives me goosebumps saying this to you here, but off the back of picking up a newspaper on a bus and an interview which lasted an entire day in London, I was made the chief economist of the PRS, and the rest is history. And had I not picked up that newspaper, had I not taken that trip to London, I wouldn't be here now. So it's really important for entrepreneurs listening to just keep knocking on doors. Nobody wanted to hire an economist because nobody could see a need for one. Don't wait for your job description. Create your job description and sell that in.
That's true. Now, coming to the point, you know, where you focus firstly on become an app star. If you could talk about, I mean, we all know that the music industry faced a lot of, I think India is the largest market for music piracy, if I'm not wrong. And I saw that in that report also that you sent me. And I think while growing up, all of us in college, I don't think we ever bought any cassettes anymore. Like when we were in school, we used to buy those cassettes, then we shifted to CDs, but nobody really bought CDs in India. Everybody was making CDs and, you know, downloading songs, churning CDs. And, you know, the kids outside the college would actually sell these pirated CDs for music. How is the scene back home for you? And what really has been the impact from being, you know, a company selling, making a lot of money through music, to piracy, and once again being back to making money in music?
Well, I'll talk about the West. Not quite happy with that term, the West, but what's happened in Western markets first. And I want to turn to India, and in particular what's happened with YouTube in India. But I think the observation that Daniel Ek had about Spotify when I first met him way back in the days, back when he had hair, was just, you know, to think through this, which is music consumption back then was not a problem. People were consuming more music than ever before. In India, in America, across Europe, consumption was not the problem. Monetization was. And it's symptoms and cures, right? So let's get the right symptoms, the right cures. I can bring a horse to water and demand that those kids go back to buying CDs or cassettes, or I can bring water to the horse and build something that's better than stealing music that actually pays artists and songwriters as well. And that was the basis of Spotify. That's where we had our common belief of just, you know, beat piracy at its own game. And what you saw happen was Spotify was a superior experience to stealing music. I would challenge anyone to say to me that they can get music faster off a piracy site than they can do from Spotify. I think in the book I talk about the play button on Spotify presses play 285 milliseconds after you actually press play on that glass screen on your phone. I mean, there's a theory to that, which is 285 milliseconds is a point where the brain can't see delay. So the engineers who built the original client back in the day wanted to music feel like it was instant, that it was inside your phone, 60 million songs. So what was really interesting in terms of the journey of A, having this business, you know, back in the 90s where you'd sell CDs by the weight of pallet, it was so easy to make money in music. Then the next 10 years, the first 10 years of the millennium, where the business fell off a cliff and lost half its value. Then the second 10 years was, well, the reason why we're losing value is not because of consumption. That's fine. It's monetization. Let's build a monetization model around this consumption. And today we think about this crazy journey that we've been on in music. Well, how different is it from the consumer compared to June 1999 when they woke up to Napster? They go to the internet and they can access all these songs. That basic point hasn't changed throughout this whole crazy journey. Now, if I pause there and then just quickly refer to India, what would be interesting for me with India is to understand the scale of piracy since, and I think it was 2018, when data costs fell in India and YouTube exploded. I mean, in 1 year, YouTube on record said they had over 240 million music users in India. One country, one platform, 240 million, quarter of a billion people were engaged. And now I'm hearing it's north of 350 million people in India are using YouTube to listen to music. That's not piracy. There are challenges with the YouTube model, but that's not piracy. So what I would love to know is, given the collapse of data costs, the explosion of YouTube, has that actually solved the problem of piracy in India as well? Or where does that leave the old piracy market? That would be an interesting one to explore as well, which is, can YouTube then grow a subscription business out of those people over time? How would you set the price for that? What does the entrance of Spotify into India do to that market as well? So yeah, it's a fascinating journey that India's been on very recently, but you know, I wouldn't be surprised if the sort of the white van CD bootlegging people are like, nobody wants my pirated CDs anymore. And that, by the way, that actually happened in Latin America. There used to be lobby groups representing bootleg CD sellers who would lobby government saying, you know, online piracy is killing our illegal business. Help us. It's kind of funny. But yeah, it's, stepping back, it's just really interesting to understand what I call black markets. So off-legal markets helps you understand how commerce expects. You know, what did Adam Smith say in the 1700s? One man's smuggler is another man's entrepreneur. So yeah, India's got some fascinating journey in the past 2 to 3 years, thanks to those data costs collapsing, thanks to YouTube exploding.
True. But if you could explain the listeners, you know, when you talk about, there's so many interesting nuggets that you have in the book when you talk about how most of the songs that are now on Billboard or, you know, the chart busters, they're shorter songs. People are making shorter songs.
Yeah.
And only you apparently, and I just read it in a book and I realized that if people listen to a song for 30 seconds, it's when they get paid. So you have to be there. And most people are now playing chorus in the beginning so that it hooks you up till the 30 seconds. If you could share some interesting stuff about it.
Well, this is in a chapter called Paying Attention, and I appreciate English is widely spoken in India. It's very interesting to think about the chapter title, first of all. Paying attention is what we say in English, the currency of paying. You know, you pay at the till to buy goods, you pay attention. If you look at other languages, I'll name a few, French, Spanish, Swedish, it's offer, share, or give attention. But in English, we use a currency of paying. That suggests our time has value. And in that chapter, I'm talking about how scarce our attention has become, how everybody's competing for our time. And if somebody wins our attention, that means everyone else loses and has less attention to compete for. And it's affecting music. So, you know, I think in the book, I start off with the example of an anthem by the Irish rock band U2 called Where the Streets Have No Name. That song, if you listen to that song all the way through, tough, I know, but if you listen to it all the way through, it takes 2 minutes and 8 seconds before the vocals come in. That song was written in the late 80s. It's known across the world. It's an anthem for Irish Americans. You know, 2 minutes, 8 seconds before you hear Bono's voice. And I'm going to ask you, do you think that today's millennials would wait 2 minutes and 8 seconds before the voice comes in on a song?
No.
Doesn't happen anymore. They'd be skipping. They'd be swiping left, right? They'd be swiping right. So what you're seeing happen with music in today's age, and it's a case of show business and the business of shows, the tail that wags the dog here, is the business model of streaming is affecting how songs are being written and recorded. First thing is they're getting shorter, way shorter. Lil Nas X, Old Town Road, that was fading out after 2 minutes and 9 seconds. So before Bono's voice came in, that song was actually on its way out. So songs are generally lasting 2 minutes, 30 seconds, 2 minutes, 45 seconds. They used to last over 4 minutes. That's way down now. Second thing is the choruses are being moved to the front. That is, instead of introduction sequence, verse, bridge, chorus, verse, bridge, chorus, guitar solo, fade, rock music for the past 40 years. Now we shove the chorus right at the front of the song. And that's explained by the streaming economics business model, which says you only get paid if you've been played for more than 30 seconds. So I don't want you to skip that song. So I'm going to shove the catchiest part right at the front to make sure that you go for 30 seconds. Second thing is you don't get paid a penny more for lasting 1 second more. So all of a sudden now, it makes total rational sense for songwriters to write shorter songs with a chorus at the front. Some people hear this and think, oh my God, streaming is destroying culture. Streaming is destroying art. Cool heads, chill out. We've been here before. This is a very important point in Tarzan Economics, is to give the reader the confidence to navigate disruption. Yes, when you learn that, you think this is terrible. But you only have to go back to the 1950s and 1960s and look at jukeboxes in America. What was a jukebox? A way for paying for on-demand music. Let's abstract it for a second. Not that different from Spotify. And the mafia would run jukeboxes. And the mafia were determined that every song should last no more than 2 minutes, 30 seconds. You think about Motown records at that time. Why? Because it maximized the value that came from the jukebox. So we've been here before, we'll be here again, but for the time being, get used to shorter songs with a chorus at the front, and don't be skipping them either, otherwise your artists don't get paid.
I wanted to understand, you know, when we talk about K-pop, K-pop is the rage everywhere, and I think more Americans listen to K-pop than a lot of Asian countries too, because that's one of the data numbers that I keep seeing for a lot of these bands like BTS, NCT, etc. But I still see them releasing CDs because they're the only, I don't ever see Justin Bieber sitting and releasing a CD, but you'll always see a K-pop band always releasing a CD with the box, etc. And there's this huge mass fan following that they have who who just get into this frenzy of doing numbers on YouTube on, oh, they removed our numbers, you have to get back there, we have to put this at number. It's just crazy out there if you go and check these posts that keep happening. If you follow it, how crazy has it become to make a song number one, or, you know, to keep it to be in the top five charts for all of these streaming platforms?
I can tell you an amazing story about K-pop and the band BTS. Their record label here in London were working on a marketing campaign for the album, and they suddenly realized there was a billboard put up on Piccadilly Circus, a very famous location in central London, very famous for its billboards and its adverts. And there was like a furore in the record label, like, who did that? We haven't signed off the marketing budget. We haven't even developed a marketing strategy. Wait. We haven't even decided how we're going to brand this band, and there's already billboards gone up. You know, somebody was going to get fired in the record label. So a big meeting, management involved, and they realized fans had put the billboard up in Piccadilly Circus, not the record label.
Yeah.
Oh, the fans are so keen to advertise the band, they've actually gone and invested in a billboard themselves, and the record label is slow to the market and picking up on it. So there is fandom there. And I think that there's something to be said here, which is popular is popular wherever it is popular. And K-pop is popular in streaming services. It's also popular in CD formats. It's also going to be popular in other formats. I remember doing some analysis of K-pop back in 2018-19. I remember Spotify has only recently launched in Korea, yet K-pop was the biggest genre that we were working with around the world. So we weren't even in the country it was coming from, but we were exporting this music around the world. So playlists are without borders. We used to say this about indie music, and I'm sure we can get into this later, but just, you know, could we break a K-pop artist even though we're not in Korea? Absolutely. Could we break an Indian artist even though back then we weren't in India? Absolutely. Playlists are without borders. And I think Lima was the number one city for K-pop outside of Korea. Lima in Peru, doesn't make any sense. But it does, because you have the data, you can watch where it's being consumed. What I think is a big takeaway here, though, which is transferable for all your listeners on Forbes India, is just how these kind of cross-pollinating relationships can happen. So in the music industry here in the UK, and certainly in America and across most European markets, streaming, paying £120 a year for music, is growing like crazy. And vinyl is growing like crazy. So I got a bargain, £10 a month for a streaming service. It's been £10 for almost 20 years now. That is a bargain, 60 million songs. And then I've got a luxury of owning a £25 vinyl record, which, by the way, going back to our books analogy at the start, Pooja, I might not actually open nor listen to, but I just want it in my house, okay? But it's the same consumer paying for both. The consumer that's paying for the bargain is also paying for a luxury. They're not paying for the stuff in the middle, a CD, a cassette, or an iTunes download. And I'm seeing that parallel everywhere I look. So I can leave music and media for a second. In aviation, up until the pandemic, low-cost carriers were winning market share. Upper-range carriers like Singapore Airlines, Emirates were winning market share. The companies in the middle, Cathay Pacific, British Airways, they were losing out. I see it in supermarkets on the high street. So I think there is something to be said about, you know, fandom, back to BTS and K-pop. But when you're passionate about something, you can go to either end of the spectrum. What's the bargain offering on one end? And what's the luxury offering on the other end? But I don't want what's left in the middle there. And I think that's a useful thing for marketeers that are listening to the podcast to think long and hard about, is you're marketing two very different products to exactly the same people.
That's true. There's one thing that I wanted to understand. When you write in your book, you know, there's need to understand a concept central to how the music business and many other businesses sees the world. You have written that it's a deeply flawed and rather silly sounding acronym, ARPU, Average Revenue Per User. Why do you say so? And what, if you could explain to the listeners, why is, because as we know it, whenever anybody writes a copy or whenever you're trying to say something, you say, oh, the ARPU is this and this is this.
Yeah.
And basically means this is the most important metric. But why do you think it's not that important?
Well, let's just pick it apart. So if Forbes are running an article about telco competition in India, for example, you might see a reference to ARPU snuck in the second paragraph. ARPU is X, therefore it's a good deal. ARPU is Y, therefore it's a bad deal. Oh, so Is that how the world works? Just four-letter acronym, and now I know the answer to all these complicated questions. What is A, average, the mean? Well, we could look at the median, we could look at the mode, we could look at volatility of that over time. We could look at that in purchasing power parity, or reverse a way of comparing that payment in India to other countries that have been successful with that product. We can talk about that at length, but we can't just say average is all you need to know. Revenue, often misunderstood. Is it gross revenue? Is it net revenue after sales tax? Is it revenue to the telco provider? Is it revenue to the rights holder? And user, what is a unique user? That's one of the biggest challenges that we've got. And when I look at some of the tech that's coming out of India just now, trying to measure audiences, there's a lot of dark arts involved in measuring audiences. I'll just give you one and we can explore more at will, but you know, measuring audiences for, say, tech products by IP addresses, big no-no. I've used 5 IP addresses today already. So if I've used that app using 5 IP addresses, I am not 5 people. Okay, I'm one person with one pulse, not 5 people with 5 pulses. So don't count me as 5 people. I think those are the types of errors that you're seeing. Measuring a smartphone population by handsets. Well, what if people carry 2 phones, which many people do, work and home? Well, they're not 2 people, they're one person. So let's scroll down what is a unique user. So when you think about ARPU, and each of those 4 letters are issues. And all I'm trying to encourage for the readers to be a little bit more cynical, a bit more street smart when given a simple acronym that explains the world, to actually understand what those letters really mean.
True. But, you know, one thing I wanted to understand, we all have been using music on our phones, and I think it started if you also look at, I went to the India numbers, and earlier people never really used to pay for music. Even now, I think a lot of people would rather sit and keep skipping the YouTube one rather than pay YouTube, because in India it is 170 rupees per month, but which is, when you think about it, it can be cheaper. When you think about it, it is expensive. So a lot of people still they have these apprehensions, and a lot of people, while they subscribe to a lot of these Indian platforms, but it is not necessary that they actually pay for the platforms. Is it true in other countries too, or is it that they're already dominant market players and you know that you're going to pay X or Y?
Right. So I'll take this one in, I think, 2, maybe 3 parts to unpack it. Firstly, talk about pricing, which I think for Forbes and dear listeners will be very relevant. Secondly, I want to talk about trains, interestingly, because trains offer us the best parable for understanding how this media market's going to work. And then thirdly, I think very important that we discuss culture. So on pricing, what I developed at Spotify was, I called it the Page Comparative Pricing Index, which stands for PCP, which is also the name of a very violent drug in America during the 80s, Angel Dust PCP. Still, I got my name into an acronym and I was proud of that. But what I say with the Page Comparative Pricing is, I look at what the cost is for that subscription in India, and I look at that with disposable income in mind, not total income, but disposable income, using this thing called purchasing power parity, which means you can compare like with like. And then I'd look at a country where a subscription has been successful, which is broadly similar to India. Try and find me a country that's broadly similar to India. But let's say we have a neighbor where subscriptions has ticked off, and then you benchmark against that country's disposable income measure as well. So it's almost like saying, how much of Pujar's disposable income is being asked to spend on subscription model here as a percentage, and compare that to a country where you can benchmark against a successful model. Very different from what a lot of economists would do, which is a Big Mac index or other forms of measures, much more nuanced measure. But the key thing is, focus on disposable income and ask, what share of Pujar's disposable income am I asking for here relative to a similar country where I've seen success? And in a similar country, if it's a tiny share, and in India it's a large share, then clearly there's an issue with price being too high. Don't want to get too technical there, but the key point is, you can do some clever analysis with disposable income for not just music. I mean, I'm talking about media, telcos, across tech. I want to make this as relevant for your readers as possible. That's price. And I think, you know, when you have a high variance in terms of high income earners and low income earners in India, price is going to be an issue for mass reach. Second point is trains. When you take a train, I'm going to use my favorite example of going from London back home to Edinburgh in Scotland. Regardless of how much you pay, the train takes 4 hours and 19 minutes. You could pay £60 for a ticket, I could pay £600 for a ticket. We both get there in 4 hours and 19 minutes. Now, that is a little bit weird. We're getting the same product. We both get off the train in 4 hours and 90 minutes, yet we're paying between 10 times as much in ticket prices for the same product. Now, when you look at how train pricing works, there's a very famous example from an Italian engineer in 1851. He's in Paris, and he's looking at the French train system. Now, at this point in time, trains were the only way to get around Paris, the only way to do it. So it was a monopolist, effectively, for transport. And he said, I'm looking at this train, I see a standard class carriage and a first class carriage. The first class carriage, there's a roof, there's seats, there's newspaper, there's coffees, a very pleasant place to travel around France. The second class carriage doesn't even have a roof. And he gets upset, annoyed, writes letters to his local newspaper, does those geeky things that economists like me like to do. Then he realizes, I'm solving a problem by doing it this way. Asymmetric information and self-selection. Long words, people get scared. Don't worry, listeners, we're going to break this down. Asymmetric information says, I don't know who those first class passengers are. It might be Pujar, it might not be. I don't know who she is. I don't know her income. I don't know whether what her preferences are. Self-selection, I can't force Pujar to go first class. Maybe she's happy wearing a hoodie and sitting in standard class. So if I don't know who the first class passengers are, and I can't force them to go first class, what I do is I make standard class so undesirable by removing the roof, it forces those first class passengers to A, reveal themselves, and B, select first class. You hurt the poor to identify the rich. Not a pleasant example to use, but it's a very important case study in economics, and it can be used to explain poverty, which is a much deeper subject we could get into. But to think about how do you divide first class and standard class? Now, the problem we've got here, and you just highlighted it, is YouTube. I'm happy skipping adverts and just watching the videos. But YouTube is beginning to get their premium subscription model off the ground. Now, I'd estimate that YouTube now has around 40 million music subscribers. That's 40 million people willing to pay Google a fee to avoid adverts when the Google business model is built around selling adverts. So it can be done. And then I think the last point here is just culture, just early adopter countries. You know, clearly India is an early adopter of YouTube. They're inside that funnel. Now, once you've got your consumers inside that funnel, where you go tomorrow is a very different question from when you have them outside your funnel, which would be the case for, let's say, Spotify or Apple as well. So let's see. I mean, YouTube could make the advertising model work in India. It's going to be a challenge. But if they can get that sweet spot of pricing right, a whole lot of people would decide they want to go first class, just like in that training example. And I think that's there's reasons to be optimistic there.
True. Now, coming to the part, you know, the book has, you've written about 8 pivots. If you could explain the other things that you wanted to talk to tell the listeners from your book, because I understand that you've used music as a base for the book, but it is applicable to every other sector. So if you could just explain in detail.
Maybe the best way to do this, Pooja, would be for me to just give you very 8 concise, succinct bullets for each principle, and then we can twist and turn our way through them. But we're gonna hold on to the first vine, and then we're gonna swing on to the second, the third, the fourth, and we're gonna go through 8 vines. Me, Tars, and Eugene here. Okay. So Tars in economics, principle number 1, is simply giving you the confidence to let go of the old vine of doing business, the vine that keeps you off the jungle floor. And you've got to reach out to the new vine and overcome that fear of the unknown. And let me remind the listeners that old vine could easily let go of you. And I think we're beginning to see that now because of the pandemic. You just can't hold on to the high street model anymore, given that e-commerce has taken off. Number 2, paying attention. We've already discussed briefly, but just simply the contestability of attention. If attention is scarce, and let's say Netflix wins, that means everyone else loses because Netflix has monopolized our time. So we all have less time to compete for. 3, principle number 3, vine number 3, is drawing a crowd. And that's just hammering home the point that in today's marketplace, the gatekeepers are gone. You need influencers. You need things to go viral from the bottom up as opposed to the top down. There's a wealth of information out there. So how are you going to stand above that noise? The old rules don't apply anymore. 4, make or buy. A really wonderful question for entrepreneurs listening to this podcast. When do you do things yourself? And when do you seek control to an intermediary? We always ask that question. I was once told the definition of capitalism is when you employ somebody else to cut your grass in your garden because you can do something more productive with your time. A beautiful example of capitalism. I love cutting grass, but if I can do something productive with my time, I'll employ a gardener to cut my grass. And it's that make or buy decision that we all stare at. And there's an exclusive insight there into an English rock band called Radiohead and what they did with their In Rainbows project. Five, self-interest versus the common good. Super relevant for India, given the complexity of the country, the need for collective action. When do you compete with your competitors and when do you cooperate with them? Six, goes into pivotal thinking. There, it's possibly the most challenging topic and definitely relevant to Modi's administration, which is what do you do about regulating tech? I argue that monopolies are entities that reduce output and increase cost. Lots of people talk about tech like they're monopolies. And what I see is that tech monopolies, the plural, there's more than one, which is an oxymoron. Tech monopolies expand output and reduce cost. Line number seven is judging the state we're in. So relevant for the Modi administration of just what matters most is being measured least. Quick example, the recovery as we come out of this pandemic, and this is Freedom Day in the UK. I could come up to you, Pooja, and say, I'm going to measure the economic recovery by looking at pollution levels. You could say, fine, how are we doing? Pollution is 80% where it was in February 2020 before the pandemic took over. Oh, great, we're almost back to our very best. Is that really how we want to measure the recovery? Or do we want a better new normal? Very important to think about that because you could measure the recovery by tracking pollution. You should, perhaps, but you wouldn't want to. Then lastly, and crucial for Forbes India listeners is big data, big mistakes, just the addiction to big data. The ability to produce a data dashboard every minute, literally, in some of these companies. I just trying to swing the pendulum back from an addiction to big data towards common sense. Please don't just understand the data points, but understand the consumer that created those data points. So we can sow that seed in companies and tech startups today. Will be in a better place. How many people in companies know where their customer support teams are? If you don't, you have a problem.
True. Well, there's one point I wanted to discuss when you talked about this. A lot of these startups, even in India, a lot of countries, startups actually become the hot word these days. Not just these days, over the last 6, 7 years, startups have taken shape, and there's this monopoly that is getting created in each and every sector, even in startups. There'll be one or two, everyone else is falling down the pecking order. Is that how we are going to evolve?
Well, you just used the word monopolies again. And I had a letter in The Economist 3 weeks ago, which I'll make sure that your readers can track, which just cited Screaming Lord Sutch from the Monster Raving Loony Party, a hilarious party, a sarcastic party in British politics. Very clever policies, but used comedy to make fun of the policies. And he used to always ask the question, we need two competition authorities. How can you have a monopoly in charge of upholding competition? Stop for a second and think about this. I'm going to have a monopoly institution called the Indian Competition Commission, and they're in charge of upholding competition. Well, what if I've got a better idea for upholding competition? So it's just very interesting about this kind of dilemma that we've got about what to do about all of these tech monopolies. Now, I want to hammer this home. We talk about it with an S on the end. Plural, monopolies. Stop the bus, people. Get off. Have a look at the problem. There's all these tech companies, and we're calling them all monopolies. So I think there's something to be said about just tech companies are different from the textbooks. You could spend £9,000 in the UK studying at London School of Economics this year, and you will be taught monopoly in an outdated textbook that doesn't apply. It just doesn't apply, Pooja. It doesn't work like that anymore. Tech companies expand output, they often eliminate cost, and they compete for convenience, and they're scaling globally. So we just should expect them to be bigger than national monopolies of the past. We should expect them to be larger. They're serving a purpose. You can communicate with expat Indians around the world a lot easier thanks to global tech monopolies with an S on the end. But one concept I want to bring to this discussion here is what I call a strategy tax, which is when tech monopolies, S on the end, plural, when tech monopolies often compete for convenience over their own form of competition. The example I give in the book is during the pandemic. Google Calendars made it easier to set up an invite using Zoom than to use their own Google Hangout product. Now, it's temporary, I accept that. But for a long period, to set up a meeting between me and you, me in Edinburgh, Scotland, you in India, it was easier to use Google to set up a meeting on Zoom than it was to use Google's Hangout product. They were taxing themselves to make the product more convenient to the customer. They could have promoted their own product over Zoom. They chose not to because they knew that we were all dependent on video conferencing. Not all of us use Google calendars. That's really important to acknowledge. Tech competes for convenience. They eliminate friction to find value. Very different from a telco monopoly, which is often built on inconvenience and creating friction to add value. Why do I have to pay for this TV channel? Why do I have to pay for this phone line? Because you have to. It's how we do our bundle pricing. Tech works differently. And if you compete for convenience, and there's lots of these tech monopolies, it really tells us that the current textbook for regulating monopolies is just not fit for purpose. We need a complete overhaul in our logic there.
I just realized that we haven't talked about podcasts, and podcast is one of the major part of as we said, information shows everything. Podcast has become this mainstay for a lot of platforms, especially for Spotify, and everybody now wants. I think a few years back, we had very few podcasts in India, but now each and every newsroom has multiple podcasts. What do you have to say about podcasts? Because you would have seen it first before anybody else in this ecosystem. How did it all start, and how did it grow to be so big? Because multi-million dollars are transactions are being created in the podcasting platform.
So a few points here to unpack. Firstly, I'd pay credit to Eric Newsom, of Magnificent Noise, as I call him, the kind of the godfather of podcasting. It's just worth remembering he set up the NPR podcast in America in 2004, which is kind of like iPod era. So we have been here a long time. So it's just whenever you discuss a new media format, you do need that quick history lesson of just how long have we had this. I mean, secondly, if I can slide into that same point, it's just very interesting to ask, what is a podcast? It's a merging of two words, iPod, who uses those things anymore, and broadcast, which is the exact opposite of what a podcast is. So if I merge an iPod with a broadcast, I get a podcast. How people in India, Brazil, Indonesia are supposed to understand what the iPod was and how this broadcast, the word needs addressing. Podcast is not fit for purpose. We're stuck with it. But if I listen to, let's say, Melvin Bragg on BBC Radio 4 using my iPlayer app on demand, that's ad-free, intelligent speech radio play to me when I want to hear it. Is that a podcast? I've been doing this for ages. You know, so a bit of abstraction about what a podcast is. Secondly, for your listeners, I want to recommend two things, both of which are free. Firstly, it is a newsletter called podnews.net. That's podnews.net. James Cridland, he has about 50,000 readers now. He's the only person I know on the planet who's making sense of what's happening in this wild west of podcasting. Balanced, intelligent, objective journalism on this crazy market. And he will cover events happening in India. And secondly, he's got a podcast himself called Podland with Sam Sethi, where they have great guests talking about new adventures in podcasting. Really recommend that you spend some time with both Pod News and Podland as sources to understand what's happening. Third thing is, there's just so much. Pujat, there is so much. We're now up to two new podcasts being created every minute. That's not episodes, that's new formats of podcasting, two a minute. So I would say since we've started this conversation, there's been about, I don't know, 40, 50, 60 new podcasts have been uploaded onto Spotify and Apple. It's hyper-competition. And there's a problem here, which is, because supply is exceeding demand, I think it's making it quite hard to make sense of the market. A professional podcaster like yourself is very different from some amateur podcaster who doesn't even listen to their own content when they publish it. I mean, let's stop there for a second. How many podcast creators even bother to listen to their own work before publishing? Now, you're a professional. You take time. You do research. How many amateurs out there are diluting the market with, you know, inferior product where they can't even be bothered to listen to their own work before publishing it online? I think that's a really relevant question to pose. And lastly, a quick joke, which is one of the challenges with podcasts is they're often too long given the quality. So I always like to say, what's the best way to keep a secret? To put it in the second half of a podcast, because nobody is listening all the way through. So it's the Wild West. there are some free resources out there to understand where it's going. But I think the key thing that we're dealing with now with podcasts with this format is simply supply is exceeding demand. Nobody asks for two new podcasts every minute. There's no marches up and down Whitehall and the Houses of Parliament saying we want two new podcasts. It's just insane splurge of supply. And I think there'll be a shaking out of the market in the next couple of years between the professionals and the amateurs.
Sure. Anything else that you would like to discuss if I missed something from the book or something that's important that you think I would have missed?
Well, I think there's a, maybe if I could offer a couple of sort of closing remarks here for the opportunities facing India. I've always, since being a kid, been fascinated with the concept of leapfrogging, how businesses can, you know, leapfrog legacy systems of the old vine, as it were, and reach out onto new ones. And I think that's something for India to be aware of. I think you're now beginning to see new startups coming out of India, which don't have legacy systems. And they're being able to compete for convenience that the incumbent businesses who do have those legacy systems can't offer. You see this especially in finance, where consumers expect functionality from their app that only new companies can offer. I think that's going to be a very big tipping point is when these, for the entrepreneurs listening to your podcast, where these new entrepreneurs realize they can deliver stuff that the old vine cannot. We could talk about this at length on a future podcast if you want, but you know, it's happening. It's happening where the old vine is being exposed. But I think that's one. And then I think two with India as well is just if India can make business easier to function, to remove the transaction costs of doing business in India, to remove the complexity, I just think the opportunity there is so huge given the scale that's there as well. And maybe if I just wrap up with this one final remark, which is, I think I mentioned this earlier, the question we would always ask for the 4 years of trying to license and get ourselves launched in India, and it took a long time to get ourselves into Spotify into India, was, could we break an Indian artist even though we're not in India? And people say, are you mad? No, not at all. We have the data. We know the Indian artists are on the platform and we can see which cities they're being streamed in. There could be a large Indian population in Vancouver, Canada, on the other side of the world. And we can see that this Indian music is really resonating there. But I would ask your listeners, regardless of which walk of life you're from, what type of business you're doing is, please think about the expat population as an opportunity. Do not overlook the potential of whatever it is you're developing and trying to scale, scaling it outside your own borders. The Indian expat population is huge. They have time on their hands. They have disposable income. And I just don't see, when I try and understand Indian tech, I don't see enough people thinking beyond their own borders when it comes to selling to them. And it's happening everywhere. And one last point then, in Britain, there are many British people living in the south coast of Spain and Portugal, enjoying the sun. They have time on their hands, they have disposable income, and they can't buy English football rights to watch English football games. Why isn't that being sold? Because media thinks it has borders. I'm going to reiterate the point I said at the start. Playlists are without borders. Those borders are gone. So please, for your listeners, think about going beyond your own borders. Think about your expat population as a huge opportunity, an untapped opportunity to explore.
Thank you so much, Will, for coming to our show. And listeners, thank you so much for being a part of our journey. And next week, we do have a very interesting book coming up. So please stay tuned. Thank you once again.